We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Sean B., and my sobriety date is May 11th, 2018. I've always heard of this program kind of being described as the island of misfit toys, where we all kind of come together and, you know, it's broken people helping broken people, but broken people trying to get well and trying to stay stopped. And that idea kind of has been central to my story from an early age. I didn't grow up in the best household with the best upbringing. My parents divorced early, and I'm glad they did, because I don't think it would have been pretty if they had stayed together. But I made a decision to go live with my mom early on, and that was in Joshua Tree, California. And she had a substance abuse problem herself that kind of started to show more as I grew to about, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And during that time, I would go live with my grandparents for long periods of time. My grandfather, he actually was my step-grandfather, not really related by blood, but he was very instrumental in my upbringing, and he was a really good man. And he took the time to deal with me, because I was surrounded. I have 3 sisters, and then I have my mom and my grandma, and I was a very willful and energetic boy. And I feel like, to a certain extent, my grandma and my mother didn't really know what to do or how to deal with me, but my grandfather knew exactly how to deal with me. And he was a influence and a source of stability that I, even as a kid, I just sort of instinctually went towards. And he was Mormon, and so he brought me into that community at an early age. I got baptized at 8 years old, and I was going to church with him happily, and I'd always go. He was a council member in the Mormon church and very active. And so he would go early. He'd go like 2 hours early. And Mormon church on Sundays is 3 hours. You have sacrament, and then you have 2 different classroom scenarios where you're learning about the Bible and learning what I felt was more often learning from the Book of Mormon. And so I would willingly go with him. And these would be like 5-hour church sessions. I was happy to do it. And I loved being my grandfather's right-hand man. When I would get into trouble, you know, with my grandma or with my sisters, it seemed like my stay with my grandparents would be kind of conditional. My grandma would kind of use that situation to inspire me to do the right thing. She would kind of say, like, she would kind of threaten that I'd have to go back and live with my mom if I didn't act correctly. And I think my grandmother had her own issues, but she was from a time that didn't really have the resources that we might now. So I don't think she was aware of her own illness, but uh, it me and her would often kind of butt heads. And there came a time when I was in sixth grade where I knew that I needed to get out of there. And so I made a decision to go live with my dad in Sparks, Nevada, which is a suburb of Reno. And I made that decision at, you know, an early age in the sixth grade, right at the start. I think it was during the first week of school. And I had to leave my grandfather. And it was a very painful but formative experience. And that feeling of being an outsider came with me because my grandfather's one stipulation was that I carry on with the church. And so I did that from sixth grade till about freshman year in high school. I was active in the Mormon church, but even in that community, I still felt like an outsider, especially when I was living in Sparks, because I would go with a friend's family and I was kind of the tag along kid. And I could feel it, and certain questions that were asked of me from adults, kind of, you know, people were aware that my family wasn't there. And so, you know, that's a pretty good recipe to feel like an outsider. And so these feelings of insecurity in my household, they manifested in other ways too. I would sleep with a pocket knife under my bed, just because it made me feel safe. And, I had things like that where it was like, I didn't feel like that was what a normal kid should be doing. And, I remember that these problems, they started happening early. I remember the first time I stole as a kid. I didn't come from a super, family, so we often did without. And I was at a garage sale in the better part of town, the wealthier part of town, and there was this small toy in a box that I don't know, I just felt like I should have it and they didn't need it, and I took it, and I'll never forget it. Just feeling that way and doing that thing and getting away with it. Luckily it didn't turn into like some sort of kleptomaniacal thing. But I just remember that. And I do remember I turned to drinking for comfort at a sort of early age. I don't even know if it was, if it's an early age comparatively, but my first drink was when I was 16 years old. I was a problem drinker, like pretty much right away. I remember that first feeling. We drank these Keystone lights that my friend had buried in his side yard that he stole from his sister's boyfriend's fraternity. He had somehow gotten his hands on that, so we drank it. And I remember it tasting horrible because it, you know, it was Keystone. So it's beer doesn't taste great anyways to me, even when I was in my drinking days, but Keystone is especially bad. But I remember the feeling in my stomach, the flushness in my cheeks, and the warmth that I felt from drinking. It was very alluring. And early on, me and my friends, because, you know, I come from the time when, as boys, we were constantly trying to be the best, do the most, have the most. And so we would do these drinking things where, you know, we'd eventually graduate to like pints of vodka that we would steal from the grocery store. And we would take these long chugs And I remember, you know, just forcing this stuff down my throat to impress my friends and even myself. And, you know, one of the early times where I got really drunk, me and my friends, we went to a nearby go-kart track and we drove these go-karts completely drunk, which was actually another early precursor, because I have had two DUIs, and that was a part of my story, and it was my coming to the program. But that night when we were walking back, one of my friends, I believe he had alcohol poisoning, and we were walking by the creek and he just kind of fell down and he just started sleeping there. We could tell that, you know, he was still breathing. It was just like, we couldn't get him up. Like, we couldn't lift him and get him up. So after about a half hour of trying to convince him, you know, I can't even believe it. We left him there, and I walked home, which was, you know, maybe 2 miles from that spot. And my other friend who I was with also walked home, which was a little bit shorter distance. And I got home, said hello to my dad and my stepmom, and went upstairs to my bedroom. And I heard the phone ring, you know, shortly after. And it was because my friend who we left at the creek, his parents had called. And they wanted to know what happened to him, because he made it home, but they knew he was drunk and he got in a ton of trouble. And my parents came into my room and asked what had happened. And I said, I just made it sound like I didn't know. And we didn't know what he did when we parted ways with him. And I got away with it. And it was exhilarating. And, you know, I don't think a lot of kids that age really know how to be a friend. I think a lot of us are having hedonistic experiences where we're kind of just chasing our own enjoyment and we leave whatever wreckage happens. And so me and my friend who got away with it that Monday at school, we were joking about it, you know, and my poor other friend had to face those consequences alone. Must have been a very lonely experience for him. But my consequences would come shortly after. When I was 18, we got caught shoplifting alcohol, and I had to face the consequences of that. And that was the first time I was called into the rooms by the encouragement of the courts. I had to take a certain amount of classes, and so this was after high school and right when I was in college, and early on I was having to go to these AA meetings on top of my course load. And I went to the Sparks Solano Club, which is an older AA club, and this was in 2001, right after I graduated high school, and so people could still smoke in those rooms. And so I would go in there smelling fine, and then I'd come out smelling like an ashtray. People would chain smoke. And I remember an early experience where I in this old chair and told me to move, and I felt incredibly alienated right away. And so that was kind of my impression of AA as a whole. I was like, oh, these people just come in this room and smoke cigarettes, and they're assholes to each other. And, you know, it was a very minimal, you know, kind of tunnel vision scope of what this program has to offer. But that was my impression. And so I kind of carried that with me, and I would get into trouble later on. I got in trouble on the 4th of July for an open container, and in my car. And but luckily I wasn't driving, but I was drinking. And so I had to face the consequences of that. But this time I forged the signatures on my court card, because I discovered that you could do that. And since Alcoholics Anonymous was an anonymous program, there weren't many ways that you could get caught doing that. So that's what I did. And I really believe that I did a big disservice to myself doing it that way, but that's the way I did it. And so, you know, my studies were something that kept me grounded. I wasn't going to the church anymore. I stopped doing that when I was 16. I didn't want to go to seminary at 6 a.m. before I did high school. And all the Mormon kids were dorks, which that's the highest compliment I can give somebody now, a person who is different and owns that. And the kids who did that at an early age, a lot of those kids in my life were Mormon, and they weren't afraid to be different because they were already. And, you know, I'm friends with some of those people to this day because of that fact. But so my studies were sort of a refuge, and I wanted to be a writer. You know, it's something that I had done kind of intermittently all my life. And then I found out that you could major in English and in writing. And it was the one thing that seemed to make sense to me. You know, I looked at other things and other subjects, but that one was something that I could see myself going the long haul and doing all this coursework to complete. And it is what I do today for a living. And so I did find a lot of refuge there, but I mean, being a writer, you are entering a long lineage of alcoholics. I think Raymond Carver was an alcoholic, John Cheever, David Foster Wallace. I think Sylvia Plath had substance abuse problems as well. So it's a lonely road when you're a writer, because all that work has to be done solo. I was very, though, because I was like an F. Scott Fitzgerald, where I would drink and then write. I never did that. I wrote with a sober head mostly, and anytime I would try to bring alcohol into the mix, the writing wouldn't come because I'd get blackout drunk. And around that time I started getting a lot of blackouts, and I pledged a fraternity, and that the reason I pledged the fraternity was because of drinking. I didn't want to join a fraternity for networking or to do community service, which is a part of the thing. I wanted to drink, and I remember going to one of our little retreats, and I drank, you know, I got blackout drunk, and I kind of made a fool out of myself, but luckily the fraternity still wanted to keep me in. But I ended up just going through the pledge thing. We did this cops and robbers sort of game the last week of pledging, and I just saw, kind of, again, I felt like an outsider there. And I saw some behaviors, and I saw a sort of lifestyle that I didn't really think was true to me. So I stopped doing that, but my drinking continued, and I had a lot of blue collar friends that they decided not to go the academia route, and they would work full time jobs and then drink on the weekends. And so I would meet up with them on the weekends and drink. And that sort of carried on through my 20s. And I bartended as well, and I served in Reno, which it's a drinking town. There are a lot of 24-hour bars and pubs. You could go buy alcohol at any time of day, 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning. And you could do it at 24-hour grocery stores or at liquor stores. And there are also bars that were open all night long, you know. There was one called Tonic that it didn't even open till midnight, and it stayed like drugs in there, drinking. And, you know, I was partaking in all of it and having those sorts of experiences. And yet I managed to get my work done. I graduated with my bachelor's. I graduated in 2009 with my bachelor's, so I took some semesters off to go snowboarding, or, you know, just maybe to drink hard for a semester with my friends. But eventually I pulled it together and graduated. And I remember looking at my dad and my stepmom's face when I graduated, they were crying, but it was like tears of joy, but also tears of sadness. I think they were surprised to see I had gotten there. And I know my dad, just because of the results of my drinking and, you know, using him as a phone to go to jail, he was constantly paranoid of getting a phone call in the middle of the night that I was dead or had gotten into something truly, truly terrible. So even with that, after college, I worked some bartending jobs, and then I eventually got into graduate school. I had written some screenplays, and I applied to an MFA program at Chapman. And it was a really expensive school. I got some chips, but it was still going to be expensive. But I knew that I had to do this. I needed to get out of Reno. It wasn't a place that was going to be easy to get sober. And in my head, I thought doing this geographical shift would be the answer, because my problems no way would they follow me to this new place. It's going to be a fresh start. But early on, I started to have problems drinking, even in the face of going to this exciting school that was nationally ranked in the top five and learning how to write screenplays and pursue my dream. I still needed to medicate myself from the pressures of that and doing a grad school program alone, because I came out here to California alone. And so alcohol was like an old friend, and I used it and abused it. And, you know, I wasn't using it like a normal person. There was even an Irish pub on the Chapman Circle that was open all day. So I would go there sometimes before class or after and just have shots and beers and just drink a ton. And I would just drive back to my apartment, and I ended up getting a DUI during my last year of grad school, and I had to go through that program. And I forged my AAs during that time, and you know, it's still I was beginning to think like I need to this I can't do. It's something that is standing to rob me of my dreams. And I realized it was for not bringing what it used to bring to the table. I wasn't getting the comfort from it. I was actually getting less comfortable as a result of my drinking. My life was getting out of control, paying these lawyer fees and these DUI fees and having to go to these victim impact panels where people would go up and tell horrible stories, and I'd sit there listening, and there would be other people mocking it, or there'd be some people that were in tears because it had affected them so much. But for me, I just sat and listened, and that was it, and I left. And so after I graduated, I managed to get my MFA, and I even managed to graduate at the top of my class, but I was still drinking, and I was drinking and driving too. And so in 2016, I got what was my second DUI. I was driving to get pizza at like 2 a.m. and a cop pulled me over because, you know, I had crossed the line driving, and they took a breathalyzer and I blew a .24. And I went to jail, and I was working as an assistant to a working screenwriter, and I had to let her know about what happened. Luckily, she was very understanding, and her son had gotten one, and she had to deal with that. And she allowed me to continue working with her. And that was around the time I was kind of pointed toward the rooms again, and I was living in Long Beach at the time, and so I started kind of going in and out of the rooms, just going to meetings again. And these ones were a little bit more kind of open to newcomers and a little more gentle. towards the newcomer. So I was feeling that and liking that. But I was still trying to get out of things. I had, as a part of my stipulation for my second DUI, I was forced to have an interlock device on my car, which I did not do. And I was driving around, you know, driving dirty, as the kids call it. And, you know, I did that for a year and a half until I got pulled over dead sober coming back from a court date where I was just showing my paperwork for what I did and completed. And there's a task force that goes around and they have your license plate number and the make and model of your car. And they're looking for people who are driving to their court date, you know, either on suspended licenses or not having an IID in their car. And I had both. And so I had to spend a license and I didn't have the IID. So I got sent to jail. And this was the first time I was in jail sober. And, you know, I realized there, you know, I am the problem. And my thinking is the problem. And my behaviors are the problem here. And so that was the time when I came to the room very seriously. And I went to my first men's meeting in Naples, which is a little area of Long Beach, right by the canal. And, you know, there were all these men there. A lot of them were older or at least older than me. And I just felt this strange sense of community and camaraderie. And my sponsor, his name is Jeff, and he was an English teacher, and he was getting his master's in teaching, but he was also dyslexic. He had chosen that because it was the hardest thing for him to do. And just listening to the way he shared, he's never been the guy who has all the things and has all the answers. He's a guy who's searching and growing and just trying to make something more of himself. He at the time had 2 years, and that impressed me, even though there were guys there who had 30, but I didn't feel like a guy who had 30 years. In my head, I felt like I needed a guy who was closer to where I was at, but farther ahead, you know, who could pull me forward. So my sponsor was the right one. I was actually his first and only sponsee, but I still work with him to this day. And he took me through the steps, and that was instrumental in sort of admitting that I had an uncontrollable life. With me at the driver's wheel, my life was unmanageable. And also going through the personal inventory and sorting through the wreckage of my past and kind of having to make amends to certain people, one of which being my dad. I remember I had to go serve some jail time because of being pulled over on a suspended license, even though I hired a lawyer in order to get out of that, of course. But luckily, I was unable to, and I had to. I was sentenced to 30 days, and I had to serve 4 of them. But I had to be at the Twin Towers, which is one of the worst men's facilities on the West Coast, and it was a remarkably profound experience. I was just, you know, I was stripped down to nothing, and we were with, I was just with these guys that, you know, I was with violent criminals. I was with drug addicts. I was with homeless people who got picked up with meth or whatever. And I was, you know, having to be with these people and hear their stories, because that's really all you can do is talk. It, you know, and that's what I did there. And I ran into a couple people. One was a guy who was, he was in there and he was going in and going upstate to a prison, but he had the Bible with him and he wasn't scared and he was friendly and he was just a very scary looking man, but the warmthness came from him was something that really touched me. And then there was another guy when I was getting processed to go out, he was getting processed to go in, and it was his fourth DUI, and he still would not admit that he had a problem. And he even admitted that the minute he got out, he was going to start drinking again. And so I just being in with those people and seeing how I could have been any one of them if I had a different sort of turn. None of these people were really that different from me. They might have just had even a couple more unlucky rolls. So I, that night I got out of jail and I called my dad, and I was only on the second step, but I needed to make an amends to him immediately because I had judged him in the past because, you know, he didn't measure up to whatever ideas I had about what a man or a father should be. And I had given him several, we had several conversations where I lashed out at him and told him not, you know, very bad things to say to your father. And so leaving jail, you know, I realized even with my dad making what I perceived to be mistakes in the past, he's never made the mistakes that I've made. And so I told him that, and I could see how when I made that amends to him, it was something important to him, but it was something important to me. And it was a relief, but it was also a welcome burden to not have to make that amends to him again, to not cross that line again. And so I did that with a few more people, you know, once my fourth step came. Luckily, I did a lot of hurting myself. I'm fortunate enough that I didn't have a huge laundry list of people to make amends to, but I had more than a few. And the ones that I was able to, I did. The ones that I was not able to, I sort of made a living amends that I would not repeat those mistakes and have them echo into my future or anyone else's. And that was very important to me. I know going to some of the meetings in Long Beach, I observed that there were people there who came to meetings for what I maybe think are more of the social aspects. And I discovered that there were more than a few people in the program who did not yet make it through the steps. And some of them had multiple years or even double digit years of sobriety. I knew I needed to work the steps for this program to really be a part of my life. And I was not in program to make friends. I was there to be sober and to get my life together. So it wasn't, this program was never fun and games for me, although I do have a lot of fun now and I enjoy it. I enjoy my life and I enjoy this program being a part of my life. But early on, it was all very serious for me, and I'm thankful for that. And, you know, as I've gone along, I have 2 years and 7 months going on 8. And over this course, I've thrown myself into the program, and I had the gift of, well, the gift of sobriety, but also the gift of community. And, you know, I've reached out to the people who have what I want, which is never for me, it's not the people who have the things, the car, the house. It's the people who are there and have kindness and gentleness and people. I have a grand sponsor and he really likes, he's a business guy and he really likes the idea of the alcoholic has to fire themselves from the CEO of their own personal company and you have to hire a new board of directors. That's also what I've done. I have these people who I can go to that I can count on. And it's people that I've met in the rooms. And going to meetings in Long Beach, you will, or I'm sure that in a lot of areas of Southern California, it's an island of misfit toys, but there are just people from every stratum of life, every area of life. And the relationships I have are with people who might have less than me or more than me, but it doesn't matter. We are there to do the same work, the inside job that this program makes available to us. And for me, going to meetings alone was not a sufficient solution. I needed to work through the book. I needed to meet with other people who had the same problem that I had outside of the rooms to work with these people and to share with them what's going on in my heart and in my head and share my ideas with them and they share their ideas and their experiences with me. And the way, and it's men and women for me, I have friends of both persuasions and it's truly the greatest gift. I don't have a sponsee and haven't had one. And I actually, right now, you know, I'm not kicking down doors to get one, but if someone comes my way and wants what I have, I would not hesitate. I would take them on and try to help them along the path, as I was helped. 'Cause that's what I think AA is. I think we're on this path and some people are farther ahead on the path and they help you forward. But helping people who are just starting out on the path or not as far along as you, that keeps you in the middle of it. And I hear old timers say that you got to get in the middle of this thing. And once I did that and the fact that I've stayed in the middle of it, it's been very instrumental in my sobriety and my ability to stay stopped. So, as I said, my sobriety day is May 11th, 2018. And I remember coming into early AA meetings and hearing people talk, even hearing the people who said they had 1 year, I was like, you're crazy. You're lying. Nobody does that. That's not possible. I don't see how you do it or much less how I could do it, but I've managed to stay stopped. And for me, when I got sober, things didn't start happening easy. I had my worst fiscal year, in 2019, which and my dog died in 2019 and I was very close to her and, she got congestive heart failure. And so I took her through that for 6 months and, you know, she passed right in front of me. And it was hard, but the first thing I did was call my sponsor and he took me to a meeting and I was just around these guys and, you know, I was able to cry in front of them and they just took it. And it wasn't a big surprise or a shock to any of them. And it was truly one of the profound experiences I've had. And it was really amazing. And, so when I had gotten so much from the program, I decided I needed to give back. And there was an opportunity in January of last year to be a secretary of a big meeting in Long Beach at Marina Pacifica. You know, it's a 100-person meeting. And I had a friend, Tony, he was secretary, and he decided to nominate me. And there was another guy who had the same sort of length of sobriety as me, and he was a little bit more established in that meeting. But they decided to give it to me, and I took it reluctantly, but I realized I needed to be in service to the program that had given me so much. And so I did it, and I'm still doing it. And it's interesting that during my time of secretaryship, the pandemic happened. Right on March 15th of 2020, that's when the California lockdowns happened. And we were all forced to isolate, you know, being in this program. That's one of the main enemies, is isolation. And, you know, we were forced to isolate. But to see the resilience that AA had met this time of trial with, and the Zoom meetings being offered, that was an incredible, incredible thing, and still is. And I've been able to lead that meeting via Zoom, and it's brought me in touch with people from all over the country. And I've still been able to fulfill my duties, and I've never missed it. For this entire year, every Thursday at 7 a.m., I'm there, and I take a leader each week. Sometimes I'm able to do it ahead of time, and other times I do it right during the, you know, 15 minutes before the meeting starts. Sometimes when I take the leaders ahead of time, it goes amazing, and like all my ideas of how the meeting should be go, it goes that way. But, you know, other times when I pick somebody off the cuff, and it might start out what I think is rocky, but it doesn't matter what my ideas or, you know, how I want the meeting to go. I have to experience it as it unfolds. And I've just been a part of some really incredible meetings. And, you know, for me, this is still a program of spiritual growth. I realize I am not perfect. I'm deeply flawed. I still have problems with certain personalities in certain meetings, or, you know, but what's important to me is to have principles over the personalities. And it's something that I carry with me into my personal life, my work life, and in my program. And that's been instrumental. And I've just gotten so many great tools from this program, that for me right now, alcohol isn't really in my solution set. I go to so many other things. I go to my sponsor, or if I'm feeling tense, I can do things like yoga or other healthy avenues that I've replaced, you know, that have replaced alcohol. And, you know, the program offers so many avenues. If there's ever a time where I'm feeling squirrely, I can now go to a meeting on Zoom anywhere, pretty much at any hour. And to me, that's amazing. And my sobriety, it's been tested. I had to move back up to Reno in June just because I couldn't pay California prices as far as rent went while having my income slashed, which is what the pandemic did. And so I went back to Reno this time, you know, with 2 years of sobriety under my belt. And I actually worked security and sometimes bartending at a busy bar that I worked at before I left the initial time. And I was worried about that, but my sponsor worked as a bartender while he was in school, and he was sober and stayed sober. So I used him as a source of inspiration, and I was able to call him, you know, during times where, you know, I needed his advice. But magically, it working at the bar, being security, and dealing with people who are still out, it served as this amazing antidote for my sobriety. And having other bartenders who were drinking on the job, you know, I didn't judge them because I've been that guy. I've blacked out a bartending shift because I drank too much during it and somehow got through it and the register was right. I don't know. But so I never judged these people because, you know, I'm making money off that establishment. That establishment is open because these people are there doing that thing. But for me, just the way it smells and pouring it into a shot glass and passing it to somebody who's broken and still seeking that thing that is helping to break them. To me, I needed to see that, because if I drive behind, or if I drive by a bar, you know, this pre-pandemic, of course, but if I see people on the patio enjoying themselves, having beers, that's like, or having cocktails, that's an advertisement for it. And it's like, oh, that looks fun. And I hear people in the program say that, oh, it looks like fun. But I get to see it. I got to see it all the way through. I got to see the initial fun and then the sloppiness, or, you know, it ends in an argument and, you know, people leave their debit card or their driver's license, or they get to an occasion, or they go drive their car and get a DUI. Seeing the result of it has really solidified my sobriety. And yeah, right now I actually am staying in Mexico. I had a opportunity to come out here and be with a friend. He's actually on drinker. He's not in the program, but he doesn't drink anyway. So it's the perfect situation for me. And I'm able to do my work remotely, and I'm away from the bar. And it's something where I have the option to go back in the summer when it gets busy again. And I'm confident that if or when I do, I can weather that storm. I have a lot of amazing tools. And what's amazing too is working for that bar and not drinking, I have a key to the place. They trust me. I know the combination to the safe. These are things I would never have gotten as just drinking and being a bartender there. Like, those are responsibilities I would never be able to handle. And I am able to handle them now. To me, the growth there is tangible. And I always remember where I came from. I remember that time in jail. I remember where my thinking goes, and, you know, when I'm in control, and to have a higher power that this program sort of inspires you to have, and to have the power of this program and the people in it, it's something that keeps me safe. And if I'm doing this work, it's going to give me one more day, and it's going to give me a way better shot than if I was just out there alone. And I don't know. I don't even know if that's a sufficient ending to my story, but that's kind of just where I'm at. I'm so thankful. I'm about to pass my secretaryship off at the middle of this month, and I was reluctant at first because I wanted to keep it for myself, right? And but I'm ready to give it away and to respond to any other opportunities that present myself. And with the ability to go to any meeting anywhere right now, that's one of the true benefits to come out of this COVID-19 thing. I really hope that, you know, pending whatever vaccination works, and if we can be introduced again to a world that is not locked down, I really hope that Zoom possibilities can be implemented into these rooms with people still managing to keep their anonymity. I'm very curious to see how that will go. But for me, to be able to go to any meeting anywhere, there should be an opportunity to be of service. And that's where I'm at right now. And I think that's all I got.
So I really enjoyed listening to you.
I'm sorry if it was a baloney of the brain. I sort of didn't have a plan.
No. Well, I thought you were younger because you sound so young, but you have to be in your mid to late 30s.
Yeah, I'm 37.
Okay, that was my guess. So you have a very young voice, but obviously there's years behind that. So here's the thing. I am really fascinated that you have a Mormon upbringing. Everything mm-hmm. you said about your grandfather was so sweet, and I was touched by that. And then my fascination, because the nicest, I'm not Mormon, but I, for some reason, have had a lot of that community around me, my best friend, my roommate, my neighbor, my other best friend, my stepdad. So, and I feel like what I find in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you talked quite a bit or a bit about at least the community and the camaraderie and like what you find. You talked about your dog passing and when you touched a little bit on the community that you find in the rooms. And the closest thing I've experienced to that is the Mormon church. And mm-hmm. I don't know where you are right now with your higher power, but if you're comfortable spending a little bit of time, I don't know that I have a specific question, but perhaps kind of taking what I just said and going with it.
Yes. For me, because of my upbringing, I had a reaction to being raised Mormon, and the sort of narrative I started telling myself when I parted ways with my grandfather was that it was forced upon me. And so, you know, right around age 18 or whatever, in my early 20s, I didn't have a relationship with a higher power, which I even call God. I'm okay with that. I wasn't always, but, and yes, in my early 20s, I would even have classified myself as an atheist. And then I sort of, you know, I had some experiences even, you know, in the grips of alcoholism. I had some spiritual experiences where I started to think to myself that it was, as an atheist, I was like, wow, it's equally ostentatious and arrogant to say that God doesn't exist as it is to say it does, or to say that God does with any sort of certainty. So I was opening up the door for a higher power, even, you know, after being an atheist. And being in college, I studied a ton of world religion. I took a lot of history courses, but then I also took philosophy and religion would be tied into those a lot. And I read a lot of stories in the Bible, and I liked the writing in the Bible. I even sort of find ways to emulate it in my own writing because I think it's quite lovely. and often incredibly poetic. But to me, I think the way I wrap my head around it, and I really try not to intellectualize it too much, you know, I think that people and even a book, it's kind of limiting. To me, I can take it, I can give it a metaphor because I'm learning how to surf out here. You, as a beginner surfer, I'm out there in the ocean and there are these surfers, they're catching waves and they're out for themselves. And I'm just kind of a liability out there and it's frustrating. And I talked to my sponsor about it because he's also a surfer, or he's much farther along on that path than I am. And he told me something that I think is a really apt metaphor for having a higher power. He said, when you're out there, it's not about anybody else or anything else. It's about your relationship to the wave. And that's how I see it. For me, I'll be honest, I'm not fantastic at getting on my knees and praying at the beginning of every day and at the end of every day, but I do it, and I do it far more often than I did in my 20s. Maybe not as often as I did as a Mormon child, where I was doing that religiously morning, night. That's what I knew. But now it's my relationship with my higher power is something that continues to grow inside of me. And I don't look to people or to specific texts always. I can find it just about anywhere. And so right now, like, I'm not a member of any church, but I'm not opposed to it. And I don't judge anybody who is, because I think it's an amazing tool and it's an amazing community to be a part of. And I think most people who are in church, they are taking solution, and it's the same thing with AA. So to me, it's like, these people are my people still. And so, yeah, for that, going back to the Mormon thing, you know, Mormons, some of my favorite people are Mormon. And, you know, it's amazing to me that with all my experiences, I can feel a lot of compassion and have a very open mind towards people of any religious persuasion. And keeping my relationship with my higher power and it not being contingent upon others, I think that's important. I think having a personal relationship with your higher power, however you define it. I've heard people say their higher power is, you know, Stevie Nicks in some sort of cosmic dress or whatever, which I don't know how that works because I think Stevie Nicks is still alive. But whatever, I think whatever you choose as your higher power, it doesn't matter, just as long as you admit that there is a higher power than you at work. And that can be the program. It can be God. It can be whatever. It can be a wave.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think I have many thoughts on everything you just shared, but I'll have to save those for later. But what I sure think, you had mentioned the people in the room being, you know, you're not interested in the cars and the stuff and the house and all that, but the kindness and the gentleness and whatnot. And I think that's the similarity that I see between the community of the Mormon Church and the community of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe that's just my experience, but
yeah,
I remember.
I think it's,
yeah. Go ahead.
Well, no, go ahead.
No, you go.
What were you going to say?
Well, I just remember my neighbor came over and, like, raked my leaves because they needed to be raked or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, she was just the nicest person in the world. And she was trying to explain to me that it's self-serving, but I didn't understand what she meant by that. But I do now, being in the program, like step 12. I get it. She's helping me, but helping herself. And then she'd also talk about the Holy Spirit always like being in us and around us. And I didn't understand that either, but I do now, being in the program. So I think I'm digesting the similarities as you were sharing. And also I'm realizing you were there with your grandfather, so you probably never, and you even said you weren't a part of, you were kind of an outsider in this Mormon community. So your experience isn't the same necessarily.
Well, I mean, going to church with my grandfather, that gave me major street cred at the church that I attended in Joshua Tree. Well, it was in the Yucca Valley, actually. But that's, you know, the bigger, quote-unquote, city next to Joshua Tree, which is more of a village. But, you know, I was in Boy Scouts, and I had all these great and different friends, you know, kids who weren't allowed to watch R-rated movies, but still had amazing senses of humor. And then later, you know, in high school, even, because the kids were never, the kids that I was surrounded with, it was more similarities than feeling like an outsider with them. It was kind of more just like with authoritative figures in the church, maybe, or maybe it was probably just my perception, you know. But in my experience, like, my grandfather was always of service, always. And he would give the shirt off his back to somebody he didn't even like. Mm-hmm. I've seen him do it before. And, you know, that is truly amazing. And one thing that is very important to me is being of service. I try as much as I can, you know, if I can, to help, you know, somebody who's homeless or somebody, I try to help the person who's totally, totally broken, because I come from an industry where I kind of dabble in the entertainment industry, while writing, in other avenues and mediums, but the entertainment industry is tricky because you have people helping people, but they're only helping people who can help them down the road with professional things. I'm more interested in helping people and not expecting anything in return, because that is what helps me. I don't know how to explain it other than the fact that I feel clean. And to be of service, you can just give your time or your energy, or, you know, yeah, you can give a homeless guy your jacket, you know, if he's cold, and if I have a spare one, I'll do those sorts of things. And it does so much more for me than it does for the other person. Doing that, because I had to come to terms with the fact that, like, one thing I learned in the program is that you are not your thoughts. You are not your mind. That's really only 33.3% of the equation. You're also a body and a spirit. And so I might not have the best ideas about things. You know what? I got some pretty shitty ideas sometimes. But what protects me from that is that some of the things I try to do are not about me at all. And some of the things I do, some pretty good things, and this being in this program is a part of that. There are so many opportunities to be of service. Back when the rooms were still open, you could take kids from rehab to meetings, and that puts you in touch with these kids who, again, are totally broken. And I don't know, it's a way to build your antibody. You realize, like, I find myself considering myself so lucky that I'm not like some of these kids who had even less than me or had considerably more in a monetary sense, but nothing as far as actual love and care in their upbringing. So to mix with these kinds of people, it's hugely formative and influential, and it's what really powers my sobriety.
For the alcoholic out there listening, perhaps still suffering, what do you have to say?
Don't stop trying, because I honestly believe even if you are someone who has gotten time and gone back out and you keep doing it over and over again, I think every time you come back to the rooms, your chances of getting it and staying stopped increase every time. I don't think that's something that should be pressed, because many of us don't realize how close to death we are by taking that gamble and rolling that dice. But the one thing I did perfectly is keep coming back.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.